Heaven sends a song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you
soon. Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. The show, as always, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And thanks to the marvels of technology and to the efforts of engineer Mike Boyle, I am in a parking lot in San Diego, and my guest, Dani Shapiro, is in her home in Connecticut, and we're going to do our interview this way, and I can't wait to talk to Dani about her book. Dani Shapiro's most recent books include Family History and Slow Motion. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Granta, Elle, Oh, the Oprah Magazine, and Plowshares, and has been broadcast on National Public Radio. She's currently a visiting writer at Wesleyan University and lives with her husband and son in Connecticut. And she's been on before. I love her writing. When she has new books come out, I love to bring her back on. Hi, Dani.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to talk to you again.
Now I'm going to be picturing you in a parking lot.
Yes, I'm in a parking lot. I won't tell you what I see from this parking lot, but the air conditioner is on and the seatbelt light is flashing at me. Let's talk about family history. Sorry, not family history, but Black and White. You were on last with Family History.
Right.
Black and White, I just love what you're doing here. You have a mother-daughter relationship. You have an estranged daughter returning to take care of her famous photographer mother after many years. Her mother is ill. Interesting premise. Will you talk about how this book came about?
Sure. I mean, with all of my books, it came from a couple of different places, but I would say that the clearest one for me was that there was a photographer, there is a photographer named Sally Mann, whose work I had always been somewhat obsessed with when it first burst on the scene in the late 80s, early 90s. She had taken a series of photographs that were very provocative of her three children from the time that they were 3 years old until they were 14. And when I first saw the pictures, I was, quite young, and I loved them. I mean, I did not have an ambivalent reaction in any way. I thought they were beautiful and that they were great art and that they were certainly disturbing, but there was a lot of stuff in the air at that time about, you know, were they exploitative? Was this child pornography? There was a lot of controversy, and I thought all that was kind of silly. And then a bunch of years went by, and I had a child myself, and I was the mother of a young child, and I revisited the work. And I had a different response. I didn't have a different response in terms of what the quality of the work, of the art was. It remained, for me, really extraordinary. But I found myself wondering how the pictures were taken, and I found myself thinking about the fact that these were not snapshots, that they were staged photographs, they were lit, they were set up, the kids had been asked to pose. And as a novelist, I became really fascinated by the idea of entering a scene like that and seeing how it actually happened and what the effects were on the child who was so photographed, who was made into her mother's muse.
Now, that's interesting. Did you do any research before you started writing in terms of did she have children and was this her child and
oh,
how
yeah.
was
well,
the child
I,
affected?
I knew that they were her children, but uh-huh. I purposefully did absolutely no research because uh-huh. I wanted the book to be inspired by her work, but not by her life and not by the lives of her children. I didn't want it to be. I often tell my writing students that research can really end up being another, you know, kind of a very great form of procrastination. For me, I know when I'm researching something, it's because I'm not ready to write or I'm afraid of writing. And I remember once E.L. Doctorow telling me that he did no research when he wrote the first draft of, I think it was at the time, Waterworks.
Mm-hmm.
And that he never does research when he writes first drafts, that he allows his imagination to capture the history that he's writing about, and then he checks to see whether he got it right.
And afterward.
Yeah, and I always really, I loved that. And for me, I felt like if I knew what had happened to Sally Mann's kids, then I could very well get knocked off course in terms of wherever my imagination wanted to take this character.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, as it turned out, after I finished a first draft, then I promised myself that I would let myself find out, you know, anything I wanted to after I had a draft. And I did. And what happened to Sally Mann's oldest daughter was very, very different from what I imagined my character Clara's life to be.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, research can be an absorption of time where you feel that you're doing something, but you aren't necessarily writing and really progressing.
Well, and I think it can also cause you to digress or to sort of head in the wrong direction and take a while to figure
mm-hmm.
out that, when you do research, you want to use it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll be reading something and realize there'll be something kind of clunky in a scene, especially in a historical novel, and I'll realize that the writer couldn't bear to part with that particular fact
mm-hmm.
and put it in just because it was, because it had been so hard won.
Yeah. Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Dani Shapiro, author of the new novel Black and White, published by Knopf. And what a tremendous work. Curious how you decided, you wrote this in present tense and in third person, and I'm curious how you chose that point of view in tense.
That's an interesting question. The third person, this was the first of my novels that I've ever written in the third person. All of my previous books were in the first person, and up until really shortly before I started Black and White, I felt like the third person was an instrument that I hadn't mastered. I was afraid of it, and I also secretly had this fear that unless I could master it, that somehow that was a weakness of mine as a writer. That the third person to me felt like it had all sorts of orchestral possibilities that the first person doesn't have. Like the first person is one, plays one note at a time. Very hard to get away from the immediacy of the first person narrator's point of view. And in the case of Black and White, it was clear to me that it was a novel, it was a story that had to be told in a third person because I had a certain amount of sympathy for the character of Ruth, the photographer mother. I didn't see her as a monster, even though she certainly did monstrous things, and the choices that she made may have been, in certain respects, ill-advised. I mean, she was a character who made a choice between art and motherhood and chose art, and in many ways sacrificed her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And if this novel had been narrated in Clara, in the daughter's point of view, it would have almost necessarily have been a rant.
Yes.
It would have been kind of a long, whiny complaint. And the only way that it was possible to really get inside of the character of Ruth in a way that would allow the reader to have empathy for her was to tell the story in the third person. And so really right around the time that I was fighting on the page, you know, for some kind of mastery of the third person, I had written a short story just before I started Black and White called The Six Poisons that was ended up being published in One Story, which is a great literary magazine. And it was the first, you know, longish piece that I had ever written in the third person, and it was sort of like a warm-up for me. And mm-hmm. So when I embarked on Black and White, I felt like I had, you know, I had harnessed it and I had control of it, at least in this book. I probably feel like I'm back at square one whenever I start my next one.
Mm-hmm.
But and the present tense, I think, just had to do with the immediacy of what was happening to Clara. It didn't feel to me like it was a story that that I wanted to tell in retrospect. I wanted to tell it really in the present of the present. And then there's also her memories. Clara's memories in the book take the form of these photo sessions with her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, those are sometimes in the present tense, but they're in the past. So it was really just trying to juggle this sense of wanting there to be immediacy, and at the same time, this is a novel that has a past and a present.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, these are not things that I was conscious of as I was writing.
Sure,
it was totally instinctive.
How about reading to us? Give us give the readers a taste of Black and White.
Sure. I'll read a little bit of a scene that takes place in a gallery in New York the first time that the work is being shown in public. And Clara in this scene is 3 years old, but of course it's being told in her memory from a woman in her early 30s.
Okay.
Ruth's hand covers her mouth as she walks in the door. Many years from now, Clara will wonder how her mother did it, how she stepped over the threshold of the Kubevi Weiss Gallery that rainy Thursday evening, bringing with her all her terrors, her insecurities, and fears. What was going through her mind? Did she understand what was at stake? It was not the possibility of failure. Failure would not have changed her life, nor even would a modest success. If her first solo show had come and gone the way so many first shows do, with perhaps nothing more than a two-line notice in New York Magazine listings, a brief mention in the Village Voice, Ruth would have just kept going, kept making her pictures. She might even have moved on to another subject. No, it was the slim but very real chance that Ruth Dunn, the Clara series, would become an overnight sensation as envisioned and orchestrated by Kubevi Weiss, that Ruth would go from art student anonymity to the beginnings of fame. Young ladies, Kubevi takes Clara and Robin over to a table covered by a white cloth. Have either of you ever had a Shirley Temple? Robin and Clara both shake their heads no. A perfect drink, pronounces Kubevi. Robin nudges her. Look, she whispers. She's pointing to one of the photographs, but Clara is afraid to follow her sister's finger. She takes a sip of her drink, sickly sweet, and fishes out a maraschino cherry. In her peripheral vision, she sees herself looming, huge images hanging on each of the white walls, illuminated by tiny, powerful spotlights. You're naked, Robin whispers. I know, Clara whispers back.
Thank you so much. That was Dani Shapiro reading from Black and White, her new novel just published by Knopf. I'm so curious about just a few things about process and what the revision process is like for you. With this book, how did it change after the first draft? Do you tweak along the way?
I always tweak along the way, but a first draft is still a first draft. I think a danger sometimes for me is having a first draft that actually is quite polished in terms of the language, because
mm-hmm.
I am tweaking along the way. But at the same time, it's being polished in terms of the language doesn't necessarily translate into the structure or, you know, precisely the right way of telling the story. And each of my books has been different in terms of revision. In the case of Black and White, I had a pretty coherent and strong first draft that I actually think some editors would have just sort of shepherded through and left pretty much alone. And my editor, Jordan Pavlin at Knopf, really took the book and, I mean, this is a little complicated, but the way the first draft was structured, it opened in New York, and then it moved to Maine, and then back to New York, and then back to Maine, and then back to New York. And I remember sitting in Jordan's office and her saying to me, instead of New York, Maine, New York, Maine, New York, perhaps it should be New York, Maine, New York. And as soon as she said it, I thought, of course. And then the next thought I had is, how am I going to do that? Because it became this, I mean, for months afterwards, I had every chapter of my novel laid out on my office floor, all 12 chapters. I think the number of chapters actually changed over time. I had talk about procrastination. I called my husband one day and I said, I'm driving to Staples. Staples from where we live is 40 minutes away. He's like, really? I need Post-its. You have to. No, I need these particular kind of Post-its, and I have to have them or I can't go on. Which, of course, I just needed to drive to Staples.
Right.
But, so I got these Post-its, and I made a list of every scene in every chapter and, you know, laid it on top of each chapter. Like, I needed to actually have it just spread out around me on the floor visually and taken apart in that way in order to be able to figure out how to start putting it back together again. And I struggled and struggled and then had, you know, what sort of amounted to a eureka moment where I realized that it really had to do with causality, that there were certain scenes in the present or in the past that weren't causing the next scene to happen. And my husband's a screenwriter, and he's gotten extremely good at that kind of very, very tight structuring that screenplays do. And we were just talking about it one night, and it all just fell into place in my head. And once that happened, the revision only probably took a couple of months. But reaching that point is, you know, is the torturous part. Of knowing what the problem is, but not knowing how to fix it. And every revision for me has that quality.
So, I don't know if this enters into it for you. Is there an element of trust in entering the in writing the first draft and then going into the revision? I mean, are there moments where you don't, perhaps during the first draft, where you don't quite know what's going to happen at a certain point, or even during a revision, and you just have to trust your way through it?
In the first draft?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I often tell my students that writers need to be dumb like animals when we're writing a first draft. And by which, you know, what I mean is it's like smelling your way through it, just feeling your way through it and being completely instinctive about it and doing what Annie Dillard once described as following the line of words and just trusting that the imagination will have its own coherence and that it will, you know, and it's an act of faith in a way, always. I mean, beginning, you know, each story or each novel is this act of faith that somehow it's going to, that it's going to unfold and reveal itself. And then revision is much more of an intellectual, brainy, really, you know, thinking it through kind of process. And I really think the best writers are equally good at both. You know, it's just using a completely different part of yourself in each process.
Interesting. I'm sure we've talked about this on other shows that you've been on, but what about plotting, outlining? How much do you need to know about what's going to happen or where you're headed?
Well, that's where I think it ends up being such an act of faith, because I tend to know very little. When I've had clear ideas about where I thought a book was going, I've been wrong. You know, I'd get to that place two-thirds of the way through where I thought, you know, the big dramatic moment of revelation would happen, and I've been completely wrong about what it would be. So I don't outline at all. I start with some characters and I guess a situation and a sense of place. I couldn't start Black and White until I knew it took place in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier in my thinking about it, I thought it took place in a small town, and that it was a character going back to the town that she had grown up in, that perhaps some of her friends had stayed in and had lived their young adult lives in, and she was coming back to see her mother, from whom she was estranged. But it wasn't working for me at all until suddenly, when it became the Upper West Side of New York. That's when the mother became the photographer. That's when I understood the nature of the estrangement. So in the case of Black and White, having a sense of place was really important.
Hmm.
But I never know much, and I always marvel at it ending up working out. I mean, I finished a really good novel today, Love and Other Impossible Pursuits by Ayelet Waldman. I don't know if
mm-hmm.
you know it, but it was so beautifully orchestrated toward the end that I found myself thinking, huh, did she know that? And I'm almost convinced that I'm sure she didn't. But that it wasn't sort of plotted in that way. There's this wonderful point in the writing of a first draft for me. I mean, if I could always feel that, it's the best part for me in the entire creative process, where I'm about, I would say, three quarters of the way through a first draft of a novel, and I suddenly understand where I'm going. I finally believe that I have a book that's going to work. And the end is in sight. And yet it's still all new. I remember once talking to a friend of mine, a poet, about writing novels, and I said, writing a novel is like being in the middle of the ocean on a boat, and you can't see land on either side of you. And then my friend said, yeah, and you're building the boat.
Interesting.
So there's this moment where you suddenly have the boat, and you can see the shore,
yeah.
And you're getting there.
Mm. We have a few minutes left with Dani Shapiro, author of Black and White, published by Knopf. Wanted to know if there, in this book, is there a character you especially connected with or that you just really, empathized with more than any other?
Oh, I would have to say Clara.
Yeah.
Although I will say this. I think that the character of Ruth was born out of my own questions as an artist who is a mother of, crossing the line, and what is the line, and, what will I write about and what won't I write about,
mm-hmm.
particularly in my nonfiction, as it relates to my child. My son Jacob is eight, and at some point he's going to turn to me and say, this is my life. I feel private about this.
Mm-hmm.
But so in that way I related to Ruth, But Clara was, sort of had my heart, and I understood just, her psychology, her emotional responses to things, very intensely. I would say, for me, the book started with Clara.
And I wanted to just, for a minute, because that's probably all we have, or a couple of minutes left. You had mentioned writing a short story in the third person that you published in one story, and that was sort of a warming up before you wrote Black and White. Will you talk more briefly about, for you, the difference between short stories and novels, how you know when something comes to you that is short form and or long form?
That's a great question. Because the material really does choose its form, I think. I think short stories feel... I'm not a short story writer in general, when I write a story, I actually do see the whole thing. I feel like I have to, in a way, contain the whole thing in my head in order to be able to write it. When I wrote The Six Poisons, I knew the ending. I knew the image it was going to end on, and I was always writing towards that. and I couldn't write a novel that way. I think it's somehow a matter of the capaciousness, you know, the amount of space and time and levels of unfolding that I need to tell a story, and it's the material that I end up wanting to write about is almost always novelistic, but then sometimes something will just present itself as this like faceted little gem that I know needs to be, you know, its own little universe, and then it's clear to me that it's a story.
Will you write short stories in one fell swoop?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of The Six Poisons, I probably spent 4 months on that story, and I couldn't let go of it until I was just, I mean, I wrote draft after draft after draft. But do you mean, like, stay up all night and just get it down?
No, I mean, you know, just not really work on anything else. And,
yeah.
And just, yeah.
I can't work on more than one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I whether it's an essay or it's a story or all of my essays and stories and magazine journalism, all of that comes in between books. I get very productive in the short form when I'm in between books, because when I'm essays for anthologies, all that kind of stuff, it happens in the, you know, it seems to me that it ends up being a year to a year and a half
mm-hmm.
from the time I finish a novel before I can even contemplate starting another one. And during that time, I tend to work on one short piece at a time. It takes up too much of my, of my head. You know, whatever it is I'm working on is if I'm not obsessed with it, something's the matter.
Do you know when you're working on something what the next project will be? When you were writing Black and White, did ideas come for you for the next book or the next whatever it might be, or do you wait till it's your project is so totally done and in the can before you allow yourself to think of what's next?
I think it can be a very fertile time finishing something, you know, and having ideas, because the mind is so sort of liberated from the fear of, you know, needing an idea.
Mm-hmm.
When I was finishing Black and White, I definitely had an idea for a next book, and I wanted to be like Anthony Trollope and just draw a line underneath the last words of Black and White and just start writing the new one and just
mm-hmm.
trick myself into it. I've never been able to do that. And while I actually think the idea that I had is, you know, could well be my next novel, I still end up feeling like I said to another writer when I finished Black and White and they were asking me about what I was working on next, I said, I've got nothing. And then I thought about that. I thought, yeah, I've really got nothing. And then I realized that it was right to have nothing, that it was
mm-hmm.
as it should be to have nothing, because if I had anything left, it would kind of mean that I had held something back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everything that I am, you know, creatively goes into the books that I'm writing, and then the well is empty and the well just needs to fill up again, even if there's an idea. Somehow the execution of that idea feels like it's a ways off.
Mm. Well, it's been wonderful talking with you again.
And you, I love talking about process.
Do you have any advice for the writers listening?
Oh,
especially writers of novels. Writers trying to get through a novel or maybe struggling with the ending of a novel.
Mm. I think it has so much to do with a couple of things, with dailiness, a writer writing a first novel is in an incredibly tough spot because I remember the feeling of you need to think of yourself as a writer before the world thinks of you as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And that awful question, I mean, I remember cab drivers used to ask it, or you know, people at cocktail parties of, oh, what do you do? Oh, I'm a writer. Oh, have I read anything you've written? And, you know, when the answer to that is no because somebody's starting out, it can be very, very hard to just stay the course. And I really think that there's a kind of courage and tenacity and dailiness that's required. I mean, I used to keep this index card on my desk. It was a quote from John Gregory Dunn, where he said that that the best definition of writer's block, that there is no writer's block, really. It's just failure of nerve.
Mm.
That failure of nerve was the closest thing to writer's block that he understood.
Yes.
And I've always loved that, because it also, it puts the writer really solidly in charge, in a way. I mean, it is within the writer's control, sitting down and doing it. It has to do with courage and you know, I mean, writers writing novels are doing it because they have to. You know, we have to. And there's not really a choice in the matter. No one in their right mind would do this.
Yeah, you're telling me. Well, I so appreciate you taking the time again, and I'm glad we were able to make this happen.
Me too.
Yeah, and I loved your book, and always look forward to your work. So thank you, and please come back with your next book.
Thanks, Barbara. I'd love to.
You're welcome. If you'd like to know more about Writers and Writing, you can visit my website, penonfire.com. And actually, if you want to know more about Dani Shapiro and her work, you can go to her website, which is DaniShapiro.com. That's DaniShapiro.com. And read about her work. She has, you know, just wonderful, wonderful stuff out there. Again, fiction, memoir, essays, journalism. And check out her website. It's a wonderful one. I am going to leave you with a quote actually from the beginning of Black and White. It's a quote by photographer Walker Evans, who said, "Stare. It is the way to educate your eye and more. Stare, pry, listen, eavesdrop. Die knowing something. You are not here long." Thanks so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll see you next time.